Today about Thanksgiving and gratitude and the biblical understanding of Thanksgiving and gratitude, because we want to not trap ourselves into the kind of an understanding of Thanksgiving which will not help us that much, because it will go so quickly and it will mean so little with no depth to it, and looking around we'll be looking for things to be thankful for, and then we find a couple of things that we're thankful, and then off it goes into the air. And it's gone. Thanksgiving will be a very short-lived thing. The other thing that really that should impress us is that when the dust settled after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, you've got to give themselves a couple of years here. That was a very surprising event, the death and resurrection of Jesus as Messiah and Lord, King and Lord, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, and that kind of a feeling. When the dust settled and they finally began to comprehend what the heck had happened, they began to gather in community and tables, in table fellowship, to talk about it. And when they began to talk about it, they had a name for it. In contemplation of the mystery of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the word they came up with was the Greek word for thank you, which was Eucharist. Which is the Greek word for thank you. That's how we got to be people who celebrate Eucharist, was because the only response that they could think of after this all happened, the only spiritual response, the only human feeling was thankfulness. And it came from the inside out. It was a gratitude that was boiled up because of their comprehension of what Jesus had done, and what God had done in him, and what God continues to do in us by renewing that cycle of death, resurrection in our daily life, which is precisely the way we live every day. We die and rise a little bit. So Eucharist became the way they talked about it. So Thanksgiving Day for a Christian, and more, even more so because as a Catholic, because we have locked onto this word, meaning thank you, Thanksgiving Day should be kind of special, because we have a special lock on it. We are really grafted to that as in ways that others may not understand, or may not comprehend, or may not be aware of. So this is really one of our days. I have always been in favor of turning Thanksgiving and making it a holy day. It's a civil day. More people come out on Thanksgiving Day for Mass than do for the Immaculate Conception. Figure that. I'll tell you why that works. That's because people have locked on to that day. It's a thing that comes from the inside out. They're going to go to Immaculate Conception because it's a holy day of obligation and they have to go. They think they have to go. They have to go.
Be careful.
But in any case, Thanksgiving Day can be very good for all of us and a very good reminder. I want to close the door on demons today. You know that six times in the ministry of Jesus, he exorcised demons. Now, rather than make that look like Hollywood, where we have these movies, Exorcism 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, and those horror movies where there is this possession of evil spirits and so on, try to dislodge yourself from that kind of a conception, because that's not what we're really talking about here. The exorcism of the demons by Jesus, here's the way they believed in their primitive understanding. They believed that what lived in the sky rules the earth. And occasionally they believed that God gets dislodged from the skies and the demons take over. And when the demons take over, he occupies people, occupies life, occupies them in sickness and disabilities and so on and so forth. But the truth is that anything they had no control over, anything they could not control, especially those things that were frightening to humans, like sickness of any kind, emotional or physical sicknesses, these were the kind of things that they were scared to death of. And because they had no power to cure themselves of them, they believed that they were being meddled with by the demons. And so when Jesus confronts the demons, try to think of it in a more human sense. I mean, if you're living in a world, as they were, very clearly, where epilepsy, for example, what can they do for epilepsy? What can they do, for example, for leprosy, schizophrenia, brain seizures, developmental diseases? What tools does the first century have to battle these things? Nothing. And so what they would do is they would confine them to the work of demons. And so Jesus, in some sense, gives them an assurance that they do have some power. They do have some power. If not to defeat, to cope with these demons. In other words, they become demystified, demythologized, and then they're not as controlling, not as frightening, not as scary to the villagers when they realize that they're not as powerful as they thought they were. They are not as controlling as they thought they were. So when Jesus does this work of casting out or expelling or exorcising demons, try to put it in a more human frame of reference. And then when you do that, then you're able to say that we, too, have our demons as well. And it's always good to know that we have a resource, that we have resources. And one of the amazing things I find about humans is that they don't think they're strong enough. They don't think they can do this. And because they don't think they can do it, they don't do it. Anything that they think they don't have power over controls them. And we then have some power as well. I would recall for you something Jesus said in John's Gospel. That's always a very beautiful line for me. They were praising him for what he was doing. And he stopped them and he said, aha. He said, you know what? You, and he pointed to them, you are going to be doing far greater things than I am doing. Now, that line is very powerful because it expresses for us and reveals to us that there is a continuing work of the ministry of Jesus in the world, and that we too are casting out of demons and curing sicknesses and all those other things. Poor Father Zipka, I told him last night, he's still in the hospital, by the way. They extended his stay a little bit. Because everything has to work before they'll let you go home. And it's not working. And so I said to him, you know, Mike, I said, in 10 years, they won't have this problem. In 10 years, they will find a more, miraculous way of curing this damn thing. And they will. I mean, they're probably on the edge of it already. But until they get a new protocol, they got to go with this stuff. And it's brutal. So I told him, I said, well, I'll bring dynamite tomorrow. See if that works. But otherwise, he's still impacted a bit, and he's walking around the room sweating. And pray for me. That's hard. I know that. The other thing Jesus did about these demons and getting the power over them, and once we sense that we have some power, we can do pretty well. We do pretty well. We don't feel victimized. As we otherwise would. Now the room sweating and thoughts. Pray for me. That's hard. I know that. The other thing Jesus did about these demons and getting the power over them, and once we sense that we have some power, we can do pretty well. We do pretty well. We don't feel victimized as we otherwise would. Jesus also said that don't forget that this power that you have comes from me. This power that you got, it comes from me. This power that you got, it comes from me. He said, I give you this power. But then he chases them all out to do his work, completely divesting himself of any of his own power. He said, you don't do that. I preach, you go preach. I forgive sins, you go forgive sins. I heal, you go heal. I cure, you go cure. I cast out demons, you go cast out demons. So Jesus holds on to nothing, okay? He gives it all to the people to work with and to use. And he does want you to remember that the source of the power is God, and that the source of the power is Jesus, who is the mediator of this power to us. we would not know it except for him. And he is the one that gives it to us. And I always say that, always keep this in mind, and it has to be almost, it has to be almost comforting to you to know that all real, effective, efficient, worthwhile parent power comes from the parent, Father, Jesus. Father, he comes from the Father. And all other parent power that's not real, that you don't sense is from the Father, is bogus. And then also remember that all political power, all power to rule, unless it comes from the King, unless it is on the bridges of compassion, it's not legitimate. It's not legitimate power. I don't care what government's holding it. Whether it's ours or anybody else's, it's not legitimate. Jesus does not, God does not recognize kingly power, political power, that is not a bridge to compassion. You don't recognize it. It's bogus. False. You still have to pay your taxes, by the way. True enough. But in our heart of hearts, we know that it's false. And then lastly, all love must come from the power to love must always come from the lover par excellence, who is God, and Jesus is the expression of that love. So all those powers that he gives you, that he has given to us in this world, must always be seen as residing in him and generously bestowed upon each and every one of us. And that's all very wonderful. And that'll work just fine. So in conclusion to that, of the esteem and stuff, Jesus once said, don't rejoice that you have power over the demons, but rejoice that your name is written in heaven. In other words, rejoice in the fact that you are taking part in the love that guides and rules this universe. You are taking part in a power that is so great and so wondrous, and you are the sons and daughters of its expression in the world today. And and you get that sense that when he said that, your names are written in the skies, your names are written in heaven. And so rejoice that you have this power, and rejoice that your names are written in heaven, and that you have a part of this, and you have the opportunity and the ability and the to rule in this way, and work in this way, parent in this way, and so on. So that all of that then becomes quite good. So now, goodbye demons, let's go. You're out of here. Okay? The demons are out of here. All right, we're done. When I was 14 years old, I walked into my church in Wilkes-Barre, St. John the Evangelist Church. I walked right into the center aisle. It was in an afternoon, and there was I said, I'm here. If there are any devils around, I want to do battle right now. Any demons? Come on, let's go. Let's get at it. I'm going to beat you up. Nothing happened. I showed you. I had to, that's just a 13-year-old device. They've gotten me since. So, but anyway, I remember doing that. You know, like people say, the devil's going to get, the devil made you do it, the devil this and the devil that. And I thought to myself, you know, well, if there is, why don't we just get him out here and finish him off? You know? But he's far more subtle than that, I guess. Anyway. I want you to go to 10:56 in your Bibles now. We're going to take a look at thanksgiving and gratitude. And to do that, we're going to be looking at the story of the 10. You finish the word. The 10?
Lepers.
Lepers, that's right. Okay? You recall the outlines of the story. Jesus heals 10 lepers. One comes back to give thanks. And, yes.
10:56,
I believe. Mm-hmm. 10:56,
okay, yeah.
In your Bible. Okay. And it's Luke. By the way, Luke is the only one who has this story. Luke is one for unique stories. Samaritan. He's got the Samaritan story. He's got the story of the woman counting her coins and losing one. He has the story of the shepherd and the 100 and the losing one and going after the one and losing 99. Smart shepherd. So he has those stories that nobody else has. Because Luke is a very unique expression of the Gospel of Jesus. If you take a look there, 1056, upper left-hand corner, as he continued his journey to Jerusalem, he traveled through Samaria and Galilee. As he was entering a village, 10 lepers met him. They stood at a distance from him and raised their voice, saying, "Jesus, Master, have pity on us." And when he saw them, he said, "Go show yourselves to the priest." As they were going, they were healed, cleansed. And one of them, realizing that he had been healed, returned glorifying God in a loud voice. And he fell at the feet of Jesus and thanked him. He was a Samaritan. Jesus said in reply, 10 were cleansed. Were they not? Where are the other 9? Has none but this foreigner returned to give thanks to God?" And he said to him, "Stand up and go. Your faith has saved you." Now you want to know that Jesus is known in the Gospels by those who study it very closely. Jesus is known as a border walker. Jesus walks on borders, always drawing the two sides of that border into himself. And if you look at a lot of the things he did in the Gospels, you're going to notice that. He's on the border between two cities, Samaria and Galilee. This is a mixed ethnic group of people. And so he's on the border between these two places. And you'll notice in his Gospel that he talks about slaves, and he talks about rich people. He talks with those who have money and those who have nothing, hired hands, the very poor and the very rich. The socio-political lines in the Gospel of Mark are crossed continuously, and he wants people crossing those lines into each other, and the poor and the rich and so on and so on and so on, because one of the mistaken theologies that were existent at the time was that money or goods were a divine blessing, and that poverty or the lack of goods was considered for them a disdainful slam from God. So in the context of that kind of a theology, he would tell the story, for example, of Lazarus, the poor man, and the rich man, and they're up in heaven, and they're up there sitting there, and the rich man says, "Hey, where do I go?" And he gets nothing. He says, "Hey, it's all damn hot in this place. Go get me some water." And the guy says, "Sorry, can't help you." So there's this crossing over, or the lack of crossing over when it gets to be too late, between these mixed ethnic and mixed socio-political groups in the Gospel of Mark. There's some who hold that the majority of believers in the first 100 years of the church's life, there were some who believed that they were mostly poor and disadvantaged people who came on board and began to believe in Jesus. But that certainly is not true in a massive way, by any means at all, were they not both rich and poor in the early community. But one thing we do notice is that this is an unusual religion that Jesus started, in that there were no pre-existing conditions for membership. He invited individuals into the kingdom of God, and it didn't matter who you were, rich or poor, and it didn't matter where your ethnic origin was laid. He invited everybody into the kingdom. And so there was no pre-existing condition by any means at all, were they not both rich and poor in the early community. But one thing we do notice is that this is an unusual religion that Jesus started, in that there were no pre-existing conditions for membership. He invited individuals into the kingdom of God, and it didn't matter who you were, rich or poor, and it didn't matter where your ethnic origin was laid. He invited everybody into the kingdom. And so there was no pre-existing condition. The group that comprised the early believers, how many you want to count them, however many you want to count them, it was a diverse group, a very diverse group of people in the in this group. So having that in mind, and Jesus as a border walker, he's going to be walking now between the border of the sick and the well. You notice? There are those who are well, and those who are sick, and he's walking the border. And he wants the well to reach in and bring healing to the unwell. And so this is another border incident in the life of Jesus where he brings these two groups together. The story starts out that he was continuing on his way to Jerusalem. That may be important because the entire Gospel of Luke is when Jesus leaves and is on his way to Jerusalem. And on his way to Jerusalem, here's what happens. He's on his way to Jerusalem for death and resurrection. And here's what happens on the way as he's walking the border. And he, you might also notice that the major border that he walks on is the border between heaven and earth. Okay? Drawing the two together, fusing heaven and earth so that we would know finally and definitively that earth and heaven are joined. Okay? In the hearts of humans, when the kingdom of God is present, heaven and earth are joined. Heaven is not some place, not another existence. Heaven and earth are joined together in Jesus Christ, who took on flesh. So that's the major border that he walks. And he's always trying to what? Pull people into that, and he's always trying to remind people that God is where? In them. So he's walking that border, pulling people in from both sides. And that's a very important little note. And on this border, there's going to be a strange connection. Now, what do you do on borders? Borders are connections. And so there's going to be a strange connection, and there's going to be a strange disconnect in the nine who don't come back and the one who does. A strange connection and a strange disconnect. And that's what happens on the borders. As he's walking toward the village, they call out, "Lord Jesus, have mercy on us, have pity on us." Use either word, mercy or pity. They're not asking for cure. They're not saying, "Cure us, cure us." There's words for cure. They're saying, "Have pity on us." And what they're crying out for is someone from that other side to come into their lives. To someone to recognize their pain and suffering. Someone to acknowledge where they are in life. And to bridge that place with compassion. Very often people don't want anything from us. They just want us. They want someone to acknowledge and recognize where we're at and what condition we have and where we're suffering. These people, these lepers, lived in communities. This is what the history of this thing tells us, that these lepers lived in communities outside the village. They were like a little tent city outside the village. Far enough away from the village that they weren't contagious, but not too far away so that people couldn't drop them some food. So that they would have some sustenance. And in those communities then, if you got too close, they would run away or call out, "Unclean, unclean!" And then you would keep your distance, cross to the other side, or do whatever you did. But both of them knew that they had a place, and nobody crosses. They're crying, "Jesus, Master, have pity on us." So they're crying out for some compassion, crying out for someone to enter their self-enclosed world, to acknowledge that they exist, and that there is some importance to their lives. So now Jesus is on the border between the what? The well and the sick. So he's on another border, drawing them to seeing what he is going to be doing for them. I want you to be aware of two words. One is healing and the other is curing. They are two different realities in the Bible. There is a word for cure. That's when you get your body back the way you had it. Okay, that's a cure. When you get your body back the way you want it. Or wanting a cure is wanting your body be back the way it was. Okay? Healing takes place whatever happens, leads you into God and others. That's healing. And so you're going to see those two realities at work in this. No, ten or how? Ten of them were what?
Cured.
One was
healed.
There is a difference. And doctors who are pretty perceptive today, know this, they know that they can cure a person, but sometimes they leave they're not healed. They're not restored. There's nothing. Those doctors who have spirituality, whether they're she or he, if they have a spirituality, they're very interested in healing. I know, you know Tim Pagana? Very much aware of this difference. Tim is very much aware of it. Daniel Glunk is very much aware of this. Margaret Shoemaker's husband, very much aware of this healing that takes place. They know they can cure. They know they can make you better. They know they can get your body back pretty much the way it was. But what they want to also do is to get you to heal, which is different. And that's what this guy in the story gets. He gets not only cured, but he gets healed. Now, how important is that? Let me tell you how important that is. In another place in Matthew's Gospel, the guy is on his way to the temple, right? To do the religious, assigned, sacred duty of being at the temple to offer sacrifice, right? He's on his way. He's on his way. And all of a sudden he remembers that his brother has something against him. He stops. He doesn't go forward. He stops. He doesn't go forward. Drops the gift, goes back, and is reconciled with his brother. Then Jesus says, then he goes and offers his gift. Now that's what you call healing. Okay? And so the same thing happens to this guy. They're all trotting down the road saying, hey, we're back in business. Hey, look at them. They're all back. The fingers and the toes are moving. Oh, this is great, they're saying to themselves. Ha ha, ha ha. Don't go there, they say. Jesus says, that's not where you go. Aha, we're back in business. You're not back in business until you're what? Healed. That's the understanding. And you're not back in business. The immediate thing when you get out of the house, they say, oh, great, I'm back. I can do my work now and do it all. Just slow down. Hang in midair for a while. hang in midair for a while and find out what this is all about. Get a grip on what this healing is all about. So anyway, this guy is trotting down the road with them, and all of a sudden he realizes the wide world of life. He realizes what has actually happened to him. And that is a regrafting of himself to the roots and a grounding in God. That's what he understood. Now what does he do? Stops on a dime, turns around, comes back, falls at the feet of Jesus, and he does what? He gives thanks. Thanks. Why? Because real gratitude can only come when our hearts are healed and we understand the place where we stand. Now, let me just get this out of the way here because I'm wearing my lovely glove. Okay, I had him going down the road. He gets this realization of healing, that he's healed. Notice the two different words in the Bible there. One is a cure and one is a heal.
Yes.
They're two different words. They understood that. I don't think we always understand that. That this healing is a wider sense of wellness. Cure is when you get the body back, and so on, and that talk. Why go show yourselves to the priests? Because they could not be counted on to verify their own wellness. And so it was go to the priest, show yourself to the priest, get a ticket, saying they can take a quarantine sign down off your door. Okay. When I was a kid, I remember going to school, and I'd be walking up there, and every once in a while you'd look up and see an orange sign on somebody's front door. That's it. No, and I found out that they were quarantined. They're measles or something, or mumps or something, or mumps or some other dreadful disease, you know. And but they don't do that anymore. They just let it spread. But anyway, go show yourselves to the priest. Get your ticket back to the community. Get your ticket back to your family. Ticket back to the community to be reassembled into the life that you once had. So they go to the priest and. And the priest is a gatekeeper to this kind of an experience. And that gatekeeper, priest gatekeeper, has also been locked onto, and throughout history, priests have become gatekeepers for a lot of things that we have no business in. And in terms of telling people what's right, wrong, good, bad, whether you're in or out, whether you're well or not well, sicker, that probably got hung on us, and not a good idea. But anyway, the priest has a role in that, and was on the way for that experience of reassembling themselves into the community that they realized what had happened. Now, the next thing you want to notice is that immediately upon understanding that he was healed, then if the sense of gratitude wells up and the need to give thanks. The highest that I know of, in my judgment, the highest sign of spiritual health, the highest sign is a real sense of gratitude and thankfulness. Okay? A lot of things cannot be in your heart if there's thankfulness there. They can't coexist with a lot of other very deadly things. When you're thankful, that's a very, 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 very good sign of spiritual health. If you're, and if it comes and goes, that's all right, because all things come and go in this world. But if you're in the main line, when you come to think about it, when you stop to think about it, if you have thankfulness in your heart, you're okay. You're pretty well solidly set on good spiritual ground, on thankfulness. Now, let me just go into a little bit of what I have here on the board. One of the problems that we have with thankfulness is the history of thankfulness. In the Bible, the history of thankfulness is, first of all, connected to the divine blessings, which are the divine blessings of fields, flock, and progeny. If you have property, fields, if you have flocks, and you have progeny around your table, you considered yourself being blessed by God, and therefore you were going to be what? Thankful. Okay? So thankfulness became connected to these blessings. The lack of blessings in the ancient Bible, the way the Bible, were still back there for some people. But you're not very smart. People think that when they have blessings, they can be thankful. And when they're not blessed, okay, that it's close to a curse from God. Okay? When you are beset by anything, people cry out. Even in this modern day of realization and awareness and sophistication, they still think that they're being cursed by who? Oh my God. To some extent, we have not left that. Okay? So when you have blessings, you are thankful. When you have nothing, the reason for thankfulness kind of just goes into thin air. It kind of vanishes. And the idea of gratitude vanishes. What you want to do is this. Here's my answer to that. I have here my little horn of plenty. We all have a horn of plenty, okay? We have life, health, somewhat, spouse, property, earth, food, rolling into experiences, past, present, future, time itself, children, blessings. You have your faith, you have your family, you have your friends, you have your love. You have all these things, and if you spend an hour on Thanksgiving Day, counting your blessings, you're going to say, aha, I got a reason to be thankful, okay? So, as I see in some families, they have the stone of gratitude. Everybody at the table picks up the stone and passes it to the next person. That person says what they're thankful for. The next person picks up the stone and says that what they are thankful for. So everybody goes around the table searching for something to say about which they are going to be thankful, so that everybody has something to be thankful for, okay? And my idea is that is very good. As long as it gets you back to the source of the horn of plenty, abstracted from all of these things. The spiritual experience of thankfulness to God for nothing. Just thankful from one's heart for nothing. Because some people have what? Nothing. What did Jesus end up saying? Blessed are the
poor in spirit.
Blessed are the lowly. Blessed are those who mourn. He described all the negative conditions that people could imaginatively have. Desperate. And he was saying that they are what?
Blessed.
Blessed. Because this stuff, all this stuff, can be a mirage. And it could lead you away from real thankfulness. Because as you go through life, and as you age, what are you going to find? That these things begin to what? Diminish? Become less? Okay? And I remember, and I told you once before, of giving a Bible study at the Hilltop Nursing Home in Troy, Pennsylvania, with about 10 ladies and a couple of men there before me. You notice ladies always live longer than men. There's more ladies in old folks' home than there are men. Did you know that? That's true. Count on that one. But I remember talking to them about the blessings and being thankful. And it was right near Thanksgiving that I had the Bible study. I had it every Tuesday. And it suddenly dawned on me. I'm talking to people with nothing left. Their cars are gone. Their keys are gone for their cars. They can't drive anymore. They don't have their yards to play in and grow in. And they don't have their homes anymore. And for the most part, they don't have anybody stopping by either. And I was saying to myself, wait a minute, what are they thankful for? And the idea was that there's not much left. Now what are they going to be thankful for? And the idea dawned on me that the idea is that God would always hope that we would just be what?
Thankful,
period. Not for, although these can strike the match and get us back there, but just to be thankful, to come at life thankfully, no matter what happens. No matter what comes down your way, or no matter what capricious event besets your life, just to be thankful. Let's be thankful. I'm just thankful. Well, what are you thankful for? I'm not thankful. I'm just thankful. And to come at life that way seems to me to be what this healing could get you to. That seems to be it. And the place that I see that most clearly, blessed are the poor, blessed are that, that's the words of Jesus. But when on the night he was betrayed, he knew three things. Number one, he knew he was facing one direction and one direction only. He could not go in another direction. Number two, he knew that outside the door, wherever they were, there was a violent world waiting to do him in, to kill him. And thirdly, he also knew that there was nothing left except the Father. Okay? Nothing left except the Father. Who wasn't going to pull him out of there, who wasn't going to rescue him. And so he picks up the bread, and what does he do? He gives thanks. With nothing, and he gives thanks. That's my recommendation to you, is as a policy for your life, to come at life gratefully. Come at life thankfully. I think that if you do, there may be even a greater awareness of these kind of blessings and a more gracefulness and a graciousness toward these blessings in your life. That's what I think that will get you. Communio in Deo. A communio in Deo is to be grafted to God in such a way that you're always thankful. Be thankful for that. Because that's the basis. That's the rock on which we stand. Everything else can flow out of that, and everything else, I hope, will flow back to that, okay, to the source. And take a walk in your yard on Thanksgiving Day. Take a walk in your yard. Close your eyes. Lift your soul to heaven.